Today on Maine Calling, how to talk about death. Most people don't want to think about death, never mind talk about it, especially with someone who is dear to us. But the fact is, everyone will die, and if we prepare for it, the transition can be less traumatic, both emotionally and logistically. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with medical professionals and those who work in hospice to learn their guidance for end-of-life conversations. We'll also get advice from the legal and financial perspective. And we'll learn why the University of New England has created an end-of-life doula program. Have you thought about what it means to have a good death? Have you faced tough and tricky conversations with family members? Join the conversation. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about end-of-life conversations. Very few people are comfortable talking about death, but it is not only practical to address end-of-life matters, but it also can be a positive experience to open up about them. Today, we're going to talk with three experts in this field. Joining me, Dr. Paul Siegel, who's a nephrologist and internal medicine physician who helped create the curriculum for end-of-life doula students at the University of New England. Julie Weiss is a social worker with Hospice of Southern Maine, and Dr. Fernando Moreno is the medical director of Hospice of Southern Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you had helpful or difficult conversations with loved ones about death and dying? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us today. Dr. Moreno, as a hospice doctor and palliative care specialist, you're constantly around patients and their loved ones who are at the end of life. Do you find that most people are afraid of death, or do you see a range of attitudes?
I think there's definitely a range of attitudes. I think that our current culture is one that doesn't really lend itself to people having these conversations. And so there's a great deal of curiosity. I think people want to talk about these things, but just sometimes have a difficult time knowing sort of when to bring them up, how to bring them up. For many patients, even asking about end of life or maybe thinking about sort of treatment other than the usual care can sometimes feel like people are giving up, or maybe they're not doing their best to fight the illness that they've been dealt with. And so for many reasons, I think people tend to avoid having these conversations. Physicians aren't particularly trained to address these issues. It's a real gap in our healthcare system to really kind of acknowledge sort of when is the time that we start to address these things and plan for the future. People are eager to have these conversations, but finding the right space with the right providers to help facilitate these conversations is really key to make sure that we're sort of addressing the emotions, the practical issues, and the real concerns that people have.
It's so interesting to me you use the word fight, because I think a lot of people's loved ones want to encourage them to fight when there's a terrible diagnosis. And I'm wondering if you can talk through that really, I think, prevalent feeling among those of us who are trying to grapple with the idea that someone we love is dying.
Yeah, I hear the language of fight being used so much, and oftentimes it comes up in some sort of conflict in the hospital. For example, a treatment might not be working, might not be sort of leading to the results that one would hope. And So we'll sometimes sit down with families just to talk about how the treatment plan is going and whether or not we're successful in our interventions. And, you know, we'll be very honest with families about things that are or are not working. And a response that I often hear is, well, my loved one is a fighter. You know, they have it in them. It's their will to sort of get through this. And, you know, it's a real challenging thing because many of the illnesses that our patients are facing are ones that are sort of progressive despite your best intentions, despite your will. This is not people getting sicker and facing terminal illness is not some sort of personal fault of their own. You know, what I often find is that the language fight, the language around the use of the word fight starts to shift as people get sicker. So instead of talking about fighting the illness, we start talking about fighting for the things that are most important to you. So your shift might go from fighting the cancer and trying to cure it, for example, to fighting to maybe optimize your quality of life, fighting to optimize the time with the people that you love and care about, fighting to stay out of the hospital as much as possible. The fight people have really changes depending on what their prognosis is and what's realistic or not. But really helping people understand how to shift their focus of a fight and what that means as their circumstances, their medical circumstances change, I think is a real challenge so that people don't see this as a personal fault or a failing of an individual that somehow they didn't fight their illness enough.
Julie, what are some of the more emotional or spiritual issues that people avoid talking about when it comes to death, and how do you help them through that?
I think getting to what Dr. Moreno said, I think the issue of fighting and hope, people often talk about hope. You know, they don't want to give up hope that they're going to get better. And what I tend to say to that is my wish for you is that your hope will shift to something other than your disease going away, that your hope might shift to, I hope I can see my grandchild's high school graduation. I hope that that this goes smoothly for my family, that I think as humans, we need hope, but the hope needs to shift. And I think what Dr. Moreno said, it's not a personal failing that we die. It's part of being human. And I think that part of what we do in those of us who work with end of life is that we talk about it in a more matter of fact way, because we talk about it a lot. And I think that models for people what it can look like, and that we're not afraid to use the words death and dying. And I think that can help free people up and help them feel more comfortable talking about it. I also think there's sort of a superstition that if you talk about it, you're somehow inviting it, you know? And that's obviously superstition.
Julie, when do you advise that people start talking about it? And how?
Well, as soon as I started working at hospice, my entire family had conversations about advanced directives. And I think you can't start too soon because we never know what's going to happen. Death is guaranteed. It's not like we can put it off forever. And I think that when you talk about what your wishes are, it helps clarify a lot of things. It clarifies not only how you want the end of your life to be, but it can help focus what you're doing as you're living. What matters to you is living as long as possible the most important thing? Is quality of life the most important thing? And I think among loved ones, to have those conversations whenever you feel ready, even if there's no illness on the horizon, even if someone isn't elderly, it can't hurt to have the conversations. But very often people are approaching the end of their lives and they've not had them yet.
Dr. Siegel, I understand you helped to create the curriculum for the end of life doula courses at the University of New England. Tell us about the decision to create this program and what you hope that people who go through it will be able to do when they're done.
Yes, thanks. The reason behind this was we saw a need within the state of Maine, and University of New England has, you know, develop this online program, and it involves 8 modules, and students work through each of the different modules. Each of the modules are both separate and dependent upon each other. And I was fortunate enough to kind of give information for the communication module and the one on kind of the medical aspects of dying. So the end-of-life doula provides kind of a respite for people within the stages of dying and allows families, to be able to take time away and to be able to understand the grieving and dying process. So that was kind of the impetus behind this.
I want to talk to you, Dr. Siegel, about this idea that many of us want to have a good death. We hear that expression. What does that mean exactly? And is it really possible?
So I think it's really possible. There's an actual definition through the Institute of Medicine, and they kind of define it as one that's free from avoidable distress and suffering for both patients and families and caregivers. It's kind of in general accord with the patient's and the family's wishes and reasonably consistent with clinical, cultural, and ethical standards. But it's probably more than that. Each person's definition of a good death is individual. And, I think that's the most important part of it. And it probably change and it's not probably, but it changes throughout the spectrum of kind of the dying process. So when you speak to someone at the beginning part of things, they have a very different definition, and that morphs as, the dying process continues. The unfortunate part is, we've kind of lost some of those words. We're very hesitant, as Dr. Moreno talked about, this kind of fear of talking about death and dying. So we've kind of used other words like, passing on and things like that. People have discussed that we really need to reclaim the words death and dying to be able to put this in context and to be able to deal with this. So one of the unique things at University of New England is there's a 48-hour hospice immersion program. It's the only one in the United States. So students go ahead and they will stay at the hospice house and basically see the death and grieving and dying process from beginning to end. And it's a unique type of experience that a lot of students don't get a chance to experience. And as both Julie and Dr. Moreno have mentioned, this is a tough process. So the more you're exposed to this, the better off you're going to do in the future.
We have so many calls coming in. I'm going to go to them a little earlier than usual and go to Jessica, who's calling from York. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay. Didn't have a whole lot of conversations about things when my husband died in 2016, so I was kind of on my own figuring things out. But what was the biggest thing that happened in 2023, the state of Maine had a data breach. And I called and they said, oh, no, your data's fine. And I said, okay, well, just for the heck of it. And I gave them my husband's social security number. And they're like, yes, his has been compromised. And I called the company that was supposed to handle it. And they said, well, because he's dead, we can't do anything. So what I ended up finding out is that once all the dust has settled, the person who is the executor of the estate, or the person in charge, whatever, has to take a copy of the death certificate and a copy of the will and mail it to the credit bureaus, and they will put a credit freeze on the person's information. And because of that, TransUnion was able to stop somebody from opening up credit cards in my late husband's name. So so that's one of those things that I didn't know, I didn't know about until I was like 7 years down the road. And so when you're going through the legal things, not only find out what needs to be done later, it's not just having all your documentation ready and everything, but then make sure that the person who's in charge of stuff knows to put a freeze on your credit too.
Oh boy, one of the many things, it's already, if you're the personal representative of someone who's died, already so much to do and so much to learn in a very short period of time while you're grieving, Jessica. That sounds like a terrible experience. I am going to hold off on getting a comment for you because after the break, we're going to have an attorney call in and I will talk to him about what you've told me. We're going to move on though. We'll go to Nick, who's calling from Brewer. Hi, Nick, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. So I'm a registered nurse, and I'll say over the past, 5 to 10 years, there's been a gradual comfort and ability both for medical providers and patients to have conversations about end of care death and dying in the context of like a terminal illness, like a cancer or chronic illness condition. But one area I was wondering the thoughts of your guest about was around supporting death and dying for patients with end-stage Alzheimer's or dementia.
Who wants to pick up on that? Because obviously that's very, very common. Julie.
Yeah.
Or Fernando.
So
go ahead.
I can say that a fair amount happens supporting the families because it's so incredibly challenging for loved ones to see a patient, to see someone that they love who's dying with dementia. I can tell you that I often visit with hospice patients who are in nursing facilities or at home who have dementia. And interestingly, there are ways to engage and enhance their quality of life. And I'm thinking in particular about one person who was at a nursing facility, an elderly man, and he had always loved music and dancing. And I used to go and sit with him and I would pull up on my phone, I would pull up music, and he loved swing music. And here was this man who was quite debilitated and very near the end of life. And he would move his feet like he was dancing when we played music. So I think even at the end of life with something like dementia, there are ways to help people have some quality.
Dr. Moreno, is there anything you'd like to add to that? You were going to jump in.
Yeah. One of the things that, really touched me greatly during my palliative care training was about the importance of starting these conversations around the time of diagnosis. Alzheimer's disease is a terminal condition. And people often live about 10 years from the time that they're diagnosed, and very early on, those early years and times when we're recognizing the diagnosis are opportunities where people still have connections, can still express what's important, can still express values to them. And whether it's Alzheimer's disease or cancer or liver disease, many of these illnesses reach a point where it gets to be too late. People's mental status becomes affected for a number of reasons, whether it's end-stage renal disease or a variety of conditions that will start to affect people's thinking. And what I've found is that we're often starting these conversations as people are dying in those final days, maybe final weeks. But overall, these conversations happen very late. So a lot of the serious illness conversations and things that people have alluded to are really aimed at trying to provide education to doctors and other clinicians to start having these conversations early on. When you diagnose somebody with diabetes, that's a condition that over time is going to worsen and is ripe with potentials for complications and things. And so you don't wait for those complications to arise. You start planning ahead, thinking about ways that you can prevent them and start thinking about how you might address them should they arise. But I think a lot of it is that we wait too long to start having these conversations and miss great opportunities earlier in the course of illness.
Nick, thank you for your thoughtful question. We do need to take a quick break. We're talking about death and dying. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today's topic, how to talk about death and what end-of-life issues are prudent to address early on. With me, Julie Weiss, who's a social worker, Dr. Fernando Moreno, medical director, both of them with Hospice of Southern Maine, and Dr. Paul Siegel, nephrologist and co-course director at the University of New England. You can share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Daniel J. Kramer, DJ Kramer, an attorney with Troob, Heisler, and Scarborough. Thanks so much for giving us a call, DJ.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Tell us what some of the most important legal considerations are when it comes to preparing for death and having affairs in order. I mean, we've heard about these some of the documents that are pretty common. Why don't you walk us through a couple of them and then maybe about some of the things that we might not think about?
Okay. I heard your previous guest mention that conversations get started a little too late sometimes, and I find that to be the case. So I think it's certainly important to get your estate in order. Generally, we would prepare either a will or a trust, and it's kind of a personal preference, but I tell people I would recommend preparing a trust, which allows you to avoid probate and provides greater creditor protection and would hopefully guard against estate taxes. And if you do put your home into the trust, then if you ever need to go into assisted living and you need to make use of MaineCare or Medicaid or Medicare, the home could be guarded against a potential lien by any of those entities. Now, they do have what's called a clawback provision or lookback provision of 5 years. So if you think, I'm going into assisted living tomorrow, I'm going to put my home into a trust, they'll consider that a fraudulent transfer. So that's why, you know, it's important to get on this as soon as you can to, A, have your affairs in order, and B, get that clock ticking if that's something you know could be in your future based on family history or other things of that nature. Also, we would recommend preparing powers of attorney for financial matters and for your health care. Financial matters would allow an agent to pay your bills if you're unable to, manage your bank accounts, stock accounts, really any financial transaction. And healthcare power of attorney provides directives as to how your agent should be treated or should make decisions if you're unable to render them on your own. The state has created a form, and I think most hospitals kind of carry the form on their website. And as the creator of the power of attorney, you could say, you know, if I'm in an incurable condition, please cease treatment. Do not provide me liquids, or you could provide me non-nutrient liquids. It also provides if you want to be an organ donor or not. I feel like I'm filibustering here. I don't know if you want to jump in with any questions.
I wanted to ask you, DJ, you heard Jessica's call before hand that she found out that after her husband died, that his, you know, he was the subject of a cyber attack, a hack, and wanted to advise people to freeze someone who they've lost, freeze their credit report. And I'm wondering if this is something you've seen in other cases or if this is unusual.
These days, I don't think it's unusual at all. Unfortunately, cyber attackers get more sophisticated. And getting back to will versus trust, another reason to create a trust and avoid probate is once you file a probate case, that's a public record. And anybody could go on maineprobate.net and see who's passed away, who has a pending probate case, and potentially attempt to steal their information. So it allows for more privacy. And then one thing we generally include in our powers of attorney is the right to have access to all passwords, digital assets, things of that nature, in order to hopefully avoid something like that. But and, you know, once that does happen, it's tough to unwind and tough to get back what's been taken.
Let me ask you this, Daniel. You know, of course, best practice is to find an estate attorney or and have somebody draw all this up for you. But there are many people in Maine who can't afford that. If someone is to sit down at the kitchen table and write out a list of their wishes and have that maybe notarized by someone they know who's a notary, and then the person dies, does that hold up?
It would be questionable. That's what's known as a holographic will. Some states allow it, some states don't. In Maine, they do allow holographic wills, as long as it's signed by the testator and witnessed by two individuals. You know, the trick there is a lot of people, you know, if I'm sitting at my kitchen table, I'm probably sitting there with perhaps my spouse and my kids. If they're going to take anything under the will or inherit anything, then they would be an interested witness, and that could potentially void the holographic will. And, you know, I'm certainly aware that it's, you know, difficult to call a lawyer, difficult to perhaps pay them, but you know, we're certainly willing to consider everybody's financial situation and, you know, give a flat rate if that helps, or tell me, hey, don't worry about paying us all at once. And, you know, I hope other attorneys would do the same for their clients.
Well, DJ, we could talk to you all day because it's such a complicated thing to deal with all of the issues that come up when somebody dies. But we're going to let you go for now. And we appreciate you calling in. DJ Kamer, a general practice attorney with Trobe Heisler. So many questions coming in. I'm going to go to this one from Joanne. Can you and your guest speak to the difference between end-of-life care and palliative care? And when should a person have a plan for one or the other? Dr. Siegel.
Yeah, sure. So think of them as kind of a continuum of care. So palliative care can occur at any point. It doesn't really have any restrictions, but we typically, you know, institute palliative care when someone has a process, and it could be anything from a kind of a rapidly evolving process to something that is going to be more of a long-term process. Such in the, you know, in my expertise, end-stage renal disease. It's the type of a condition that oftentimes progresses over time. And then hospice care has a defined limit. You know, typically people have to have, you know, we have to certify that people have approximately 6 months worth of, you know, time left. And that's a challenging type of, you know, thing to think about. It doesn't mean that, you know, obviously at the end of 6 months, everything is done with. You can recertify people within that process. But think of it as kind of a continuum of care. And I think the most challenging part within Maine, and I, you know, I suspect that Dr. Moreno and Julie can also add into this, is palliative care can be done truly, you know, within any type of environment. And a lot of palliative care takes place within the outpatient setting, more so than within the inpatient setting. Whereas hospice care, you know, can happen within the home. It can happen within a home hospice type of situation. And it really depends upon where people are within that end of life issue.
I'm going to go to Ann, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi, first of all, thank you to all hospice workers. My mother was a brilliant, vital, very independent-minded woman who worked in the health profession for decades, her entire career. And she was determined not to die in pieces, as she called it. So by the time I was in my late teens, we already had a pull-the-plug pact. And in the event, she stopped preventive examinations. So by the time she was diagnosed, she just had a few months to live, and eventually she was in hospice care. I, you know, really wish that there was the opportunity to go someplace and say, I've had a really good run. I don't like what's ahead, you know, what's happening, what's ahead. And I would like to end it now. And, you know, I have my DNR, I have my directive, I have my POLST. I don't leave home without those. But truly, what I fear is that I will end up in a do-it-yourself sort of situation, which is very dicey and deprives the community of organs and is a burden on family and on first responders. So that is just what I wanted to say.
Anne, thank you so much there to follow up on. I want to read what Kimberly wrote on Facebook. Kimberly wrote, my husband and I decided to use our death with dignity rights when he is diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic melanoma. He had wonderful and supportive help from our hospice nurses until he decided his journey was done. Please talk about death with dignity. So many Mainers do not know about this option. And so both Anne and Kimberly talking about Maine's death with dignity option. But Anne asking Dr. Moreno, how do I do this in a way that might be helpful to others, might make me able to donate organs or have the support of the community?
Yeah. You know, again, I think this kind of reflects back to earlier conversations we're having about, you know, having these conversations early. One of the things that often comes up as we talk about serious illness is addressing people's fears and worries. I meet a lot of patients who tell me that they're terrified that they're going to be sort of drowning in their secretions at the end of life, or that their illness means that they're going to have to be facing pain at the end of life. And so in conversations about people's worries about symptoms, people's worries about financial planning, whatever it may be, what I find is that there are many times we're often able to really help ease some of those worries and fears that people have. The Death with Dignity statue, it's really interesting. We follow patients who are pursuing their rights. And what we found is that the majority of patients who actually go through the process and obtain the medications never use them. It's the for what we see is that the desire to have some control in the process is really huge. And I think that that's what that often speaks to, is that people are worried about what's to come, and they want to be in control. And oftentimes by having good conversations about what's to be anticipated, what can be done as far as physical symptoms, as far as financial planning and protecting families and assets and all those things, with good support of interdisciplinary care, which both palliative care and hospice provide, that we can help get people through those fears and hopefully to a point where they have some peace about where they're at. Many of our patients might still choose to pursue their right under Death with Dignity, and that's absolutely their right. Hospice has we take a neutral position on this, because for years we've been fighting the fear that hospice hastens death, and that's not the mission of hospice. The mission of hospice is to comfort people through their dying process. But it's something that we've really had to work to fight against for many years, this perception that somehow we're hastening things, because that's not our goal. But at the same time, we do respect people's right to pursue death with dignity. It's certainly a valid option and one that I can appreciate people choosing for themselves.
And I want to follow up on something else Anne said as well, which is a DNR, a do not resuscitate. How meaningful is that really, Dr. Moreno? How often in a hospital is somebody really not resuscitated or not intubated?
Oh, it's huge. One of the things that drove me most to become a palliative care physician, and when we talk about good deaths, is that I saw a lot of bad deaths in the hospital. Mm-hmm. A lot of people receiving CPR, being put on life-sustaining treatments when we knew that those things were not going to help them. Oftentimes that meant people dying in uncomfortable ways in ICUs, away from families, often receiving treatments that nobody really thought would be beneficial to them. So do not resuscitate orders are really helpful. It should be recommended by a physician, especially when we think that CPR is not going to benefit somebody. People need to know what the expected outcome is going to be. We see all these things in the media and television where people get resuscitated and they're up talking and resuming their normal lives after CPR. And that's not the case for many people, especially those with serious illness. So a good conversation about, what would I expect? Should I choose to pursue this and what some of the alternatives might be? There are things we can do besides chest compressions at the end of life.
And thanks for your call. We're on the line now with Meg Green, who's a trust and estates attorney and partner with Brandon Isaacson, which is based in Lewiston and Portland. Meg, thanks so much for joining us. We've already discussed some of the medical and legal matters to take care of before someone dies. But what about financial matters? Speaking personally, I will tell you, I had power of attorney for my mother, but in retrospect, I wish that I had also had my name on her checking account, because after she died, I was not able to write checks off that checking account. Is that something you would advise for people? And are there other financial little things that people might not think of?
Sure. And I'm glad you mentioned power of attorney, because most people think a power of attorney survives death. And it does not. So if that's the one thing people take away from this show, that's very important. Access to joint accounts definitely helps post-death. The legal problem with that is if you own an account jointly with your mother, then your creditors could reach that money. Or you could keep it and not share it with your siblings. So as a general proposition, I do not recommend joint accounts for that purpose.
Interesting.
An alternative under Maine law right now is to make an account be a transfer on death account, which you can do by going to a bank or your investment house or whatever, you can sign a form that says, when I die, this account goes to my three children equally. And they will then have access to that account as soon as they get the death certificate.
Hmm.
However, most you don't usually get a death certificate for about 10 days. So the biggest issue I've seen for many families is how do you pay for the funeral? So that is what I recommend people think about. Often a child will pay for the funeral with a credit card and then be paid back once they've accessed the money.
And that is such a surprise, especially when you're dealing with the grief, to be suddenly just talking about money and money for, you know, taking care of the services for the person you love.
Right. And that's often where family acrimony starts to appear.
Any other advice before we let you go money? To talk about financial matters? What do you see not being talked about that really needs to be? What do you see over and over again?
People always forget that they own an asset that will run through their estate. So I would like to jump back to what the prior attorney was talking about, and all of his comments were great, but fewer than half of the population has a will. And if you don't have a will, your estate will need to be probated if it exceeds $48,000. And when an estate is probated without a will, the laws of intestacy apply. And those laws do not benefit people who live together as spouses or aren't spouses or kids you're raising but aren't your kids. So another crucial takeaway, I hope, from this show is that everyone needs to have a will designating who they want their property to go to.
Meg, thank you so much for calling in. That's Meg Green, a trust and estates attorney and partner with the law firm Brannon Isaacson. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about discussions at the end of life. My guests, Dr. Fernando Moreno and Julie Weiss with Hospice of Southern Maine, and Dr. Paul Siegel with the University of New England. If you're quick, you might be able to join the conversation. So many people trying to get through. 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Kelly Blanchett, who is Bereavement Services Manager at Hospice of Southern Maine. Thank you so much for calling in, Katie. And I think what I'm going to do is start with an email that's come in and get your response to this. James has written, during the period of time I was going through the end of life period for both parents, I began looking at that time differently. We often celebrate births and the welcoming of new life. If people began looking at the end of lifetime, especially those long hospital days, as a time to celebrate their loved one's life, as a passing and passage of life, it might just help them during a difficult time. I know it helped me. Mm-hmm. So Kelly, I'm going to start by asking you, what do you think of James's idea?
Sure. I think that's a lovely idea. I think you're absolutely right, James. We do celebrate birth, and death is another part of life. I think that there are a number of emotions and other things that go along with it that can make it challenging to look at it that way. But if you're able to see it that way, and you're able to celebrate your person, I think that's wonderful.
Let me ask you this, Kelly. If someone mm-hmm. you love is dying and mm-hmm. And you're spending a lot of time with them, do you advise that this person see your own grief? Or do you advise people to sort of deal with it in another room, take a big breath, and try to be strong for the person who is being cared for?
That's a great question. And I think with everything grief related, it really depends on the person, the people involved in the situation. I think it's important to be able to sort of read the room and see what the dying person is up for and can tolerate. It's okay to express emotion. Emotion is human and normal to have, and death can be a very sad thing. So I think that it's okay to talk about that emotion and to talk about how, you know, you'll cope with that after they die as well, to let them know that you will be okay.
I want to ask before I let you go, any mm-hmm. general advice mm-hmm. you have for people, either somebody who's has a loved mm-hmm. one who is has something very serious like cancer, or someone who has lost a loved one, perhaps unexpectedly to a heart attack or something like that?
Sure. I think that so when somebody is diagnosed with an illness, there's often anticipatory grief, and that can start even when there's a suspicion of a diagnosis. So it's normal to experience grief all along the healthcare continuum. You may watch your person lose the ability to do things they love to do. You may see them decline, and that's normal to cause grief. And grief that happens before a loss or after a loss, just know that there's no right way to grieve. There's no timeline for it. It's normal to experience physical effects of grief, emotional effects of grief, spiritual and cognitive effects. And it's normal to have a whole mixture of feelings and to have days where you're feeling like you got this, you're doing well, and other days where you feel that intensity of grief quite a bit. Know that it's okay to seek help, too. At Hospice of Southern Maine, we do offer grief counseling and support groups. And our upcoming conference, Thresholds Conference, will address how to talk to grieving people as well. But mostly have patience for yourself and your grief, which I think is one of the hardest things to do. But know that it's okay to have all those feelings.
Kelly, thanks so much for calling in. Kelly Blanchett manages bereavement services at Hospice of Southern Maine. We will go to Ann, who's calling from Warren. Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, you just said something similar to what my comment's going to be. I was fortunate with my brother to spend about 2 weeks with my father as he was dying at home. And I was struck by how the corollaries between giving birth and dying were. First of all, the obvious, you know, people coming into their bodies as opposed to leaving their bodies. Every delivery is different. The delivery of my two children is different, just as every death process is going to be different. We were fortunate Dad's was easy. But that it's a very difficult process. Giving birth is really, really hard. I was struck by how, even though Dad was not in pain, how hard the dying process, a two-week process was. And I was also struck by the fact that I had to be aware of what my dad's needs were going to be when he could no longer communicate them to me, just like the people that were with me helping me through my deliveries. And so I was, the whole time, I was feeling so much the comparison between giving birth and dying.
And thank you so much for your call. And Paul, you know, I don't think it's a mistake that you're calling the people who are your training doulas, just like people who are giving birth are often aided by a doula.
Exactly. You know, I mean, we have formal birthing classes, but we don't have formal classes in dying. You know, it's a unique part of the spectrum. And so that's one of the roles that the end of life doula program will fit in terms of understanding that process from beginning to end. So I think that's key. And as Dr. Moreno mentioned, the earlier you do it and the more conversations you have, the better off the process becomes.
And thank you for your call. We'll move on to Ben calling from Portland. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and say that I have a son with a terminal disease, and we've been working with the palliative team at Maine Health, and they have been amazing. And I just wanted to, just give them a lot of props, and that they've been extremely helpful and extremely professional and very warm, and it's been a really amazing experience to have that in our back pocket while we deal with this.
Ben, I'm so sorry to hear what your family is going through. So sorry to hear about your son's diagnosis. I want to ask you, is there anything that one of the professionals you've been working with has said or done in particular that jumps out to you as something that has just been so helpful?
That's a good question. There's been a lot of things. they've been incredibly responsive via phone, email, and just a lot of anticipation and a lot of consideration in terms of what we need, what my son needs.
Ben, thank you for calling and sharing that. Julie, as Ben's talking, I'm thinking about this idea of having to anticipate the needs. And this is what you all do. This is why you do what you do, is you can anticipate what people are going to need. Because for a family, no one's ever gone through this before. And so they're not, they can't anticipate what might happen next.
And that's one of the things that hospice does that's so important. And I can't tell you how many people come onto hospice and say, we have no idea what to expect here. We're not sure what's going on. And I say, that's what we're here for. We're going to walk through this with you every step of the way. We've seen this many times, and we're going to be here to help you anticipate what's coming and to guide you through it. And we've got your back. You're not alone in this.
Ben, best of luck to you and your family as you go through this horrible time. I'm going to go to Marla, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Marla. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm a retired hospice nurse. Wanted to just share that I trained in 1974 and also had the privilege of meeting with Dr. Kugler-Ross and Frederick LaBoyer. And they talked about the continuum of birth to death. But my training was specifically around meditation, breath work, relaxation. And I think that what's missing as a hospice nurse, past hospice nurse, is that I like the idea that it's incorporated meditation, relaxation, and all of those kinds of modalities could be incorporated early in a diagnosis as part of our medical system. So that then when people are really going through chemotherapy, going through surgeries, going through all of the different treatments and palliative care that we provide for people when they're dying, that we adjunct all of that with attention to the mental, the physical, the emotional, but the spiritual can be reached with music, thanatology, with art and journaling and meditation. I've worked with patients before where I have taught the family members, had them watch me while I do Reiki, as well as meditation work with the person, with their breath, right up to the moment when they're dying. And it is an ancient technique that the Buddhists use a lot, and it's very, very helpful spiritually and helps people who are taking that.
Marla, thank you so much for your perspective. I'm going to cut you off, though, because we're so short on time. I do know some of what you're talking about is among some of the things offered at the Dempsey Center. So thank you for calling and telling us all these ideas and ways to help. We're going to go to Pat calling from Lewiston. Hi, Pat. Go right ahead. And please, if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Very quickly. I would just like to get the people's input on the having children included in the death and dying process of a loved one. Children are much more flexible than we realize, and we try to, in quotes, shield them, and they really don't need to be shielded. They need to know the reality. So I'd like to hear some comments on that.
Yeah, Pat, thank you so much. Julie, go ahead.
I am not an expert on working with children. Actually, Kelly is. She would be the one that
she's
no longer on the call. Kids have different levels of what they can understand at different times in their lives. And when a child faces the death of a loved one, you approach it in the developmentally appropriate way, knowing that they're going to revisit that as they get older and they're able to take in more.
Okay, Pat, I'm sorry not to have more of an answer for that. Let's see. I'm going to roll the dice and try one more call. Becky in Old Orchard Beach. Becky, if you could be super quick, that'd be great.
Thanks for taking my call, Jennifer. Jennifer, I just wanted to state that I had the honor and privilege to be a hospice volunteer with Beacon Hospice. And some of the patients I had for 10 minutes, and my longest patient was over a year because he had Alzheimer's. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Becky. And thank you for volunteering at hospice. And I know that my guests thank you as well. And I want to thank my guests today. Such a big topic. I think we have scratched the surface, but some meaningful conversation today. Thank you to Dr. Paul Siegel, who is a physician and course co-director at the University of New England for the new Death Doula Program. Julie Weiss is a social worker with Hospice of Southern Maine, and Dr. Fernando Moreno is medical director of Hospice of Southern Maine. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Also, we encourage you to download an app that enables you to send us voice messages easily. That app is called Maine Public Vox Pop. Try it out. I'll be in Jackman with two astronomers watching the eclipse on Monday. Join us then. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.